online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5. In the last few minutes, the host city of the 2017 World Athletics Championships has been announced in Monte Carlo.
It's London.
This will be the first time the track and field showcase has been held in Britain. It means the future looks brighter for the controversial Olympic Stadium. London Mayor Boris Johnson says it will aid the long and active life of what he calls our magnificent stadium. Lawrence Okoye is the British record holder in the discus. He says he wasn't sure which way the vote would go.
It was nerve-wracking because obviously Doha had a great bid, and I'm proud as an Englishman to have the Games coming here in 2017. And I think it's just awesome for the next generation of young athletes.
In other news, four men have been found guilty of murdering a shopkeeper in Birmingham. Stuart Duggan reports.
Sapaya Tharmasilam was stabbed in his store in King Standing during a robbery last November. The 48-year-old's children saw him being attacked via a CCTV system. 27-year-old twins Ian and John Meenan, Anthony Bayliss, who's 25, and his brother Liam Ryan have all been convicted over the killing. A fifth man, 25-year-old James Moore, was cleared of murder but admitted a charge of robbery.
More than 170 people believed to be English Defence League supporters have been arrested following a remembrance service in London. Police say the group was held in Whitehall to prevent a breach of the peace. Iconic British record company EMI is set to be taken over by rival Universal. The £1.2 billion deal has been agreed for the label, whose artists include Coldplay, The Beatles and Pink Floyd. And in football, John Terry will be on the bench for England's friendly with Spain tomorrow, but he will skipper the side against Sweden on Tuesday. Manager Fabio Capello has picked Frank Lampard to skipper the side instead. Terry is currently being investigated under racial allegations. That's the latest. I'm Adam Lindsay.
Bristol. Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is editor of Occupy Bristol's Daily News Digest, Polly Winch. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, a criminal hacking conspiracy is exposed at EDF. Can we trust this firm who is still pushing forward controversial plans to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley? EDF were in court yesterday, and two of their directors are beginning now a 3-year jail sentence. And on the week, youth unemployment is set to reach a million. The government plans to make it even easier to sack people. What are your rights as a worker, and how long will these rights last? Will Stone's here with all the gen from the Avon Law Centre. And are our present drug policies working in the interests of international criminals? We find out why they might be and take a close look at the controversial hallucinogenic drug LSD with Danny Kushlick from Transform, a national drug charity based here in Bristol. That's in the second hour after six. Well, on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, dry but windy. This weekend, warmish, 13 to 14 Celsius, sunny periods, but should be dry all weekend, but sunny looks windier and cloudier. Next week, sunny periods all week, cloudier though towards the end of the week. And next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of November, around about 10 to 11 Celsius, cloudy but with rain on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is the editor of Occupy Bristol's Daily News Digest, Polly Winch. Hi, Polly. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you've got a politics degree. You've also got a master's in international political economy at Warwick. Can you tell us how that, you think, equips you for understanding this financial crisis? It's quite a lot of politics in there, and also you've got political economy. What is political economy?
So political economy is looking at economics, not as a kind of technical subject that is subject to sort of kind of law-like regularities, but looking at it more as a political, more as a social phenomenon.
Okay, and what is it that brought you or made you decide to actually start producing this wonderful little newsletter? I must admit, I'm pretty impressed, which is a kind of digest of news stories, which is coming out almost daily now and being distributed around College Green.
Well, initially it was for the people at the camp because they don't have access to the internet and not necessarily reading the papers every day. So I started it off like that. And then I realised, kind of once I'd started, that I was pulling out what I thought were quite important news stories that perhaps weren't making headline news, but I felt that the public might also be interested in.
Okay, can you give us an idea of some of the stories you've been pulling out this week, just to start with, and maybe we'll get Martin to comment on them?
Okay, we had a story about Goldman Sachs. There was a big sort of row about whether HMRC, the tax collectors, whether they had kind of made a sweetheart deal with Goldman Sachs, allowing them to evade paying $10 million in interest. So that was one of them. Also looked at the Court of Protection, and the Guardian's just done had exclusive access to it for 3 weeks, so covered a bit of that and the powers that it had, because I had no idea.
Okay, we'll start with the first one first. Martin, Goldman Sachs, is Polly right to be focusing on them?
I think so. They're clearly the heart of darkness. Somebody said that they're a vampire squid sucking the blood from the face of humanity. That was an American commentator. Goldman Sachs, at the height of the boom, was selling derivatives out the front door of the shop, which had been designed to fail by their senior managers, and the senior managers were taking short positions on the derivatives that they were selling. That is fraud. That's all there is to be said about that. And if we go back to the 1980s and the savings and loans scandal of the 1980s, which was the big bubble popping in that era, something like 3,000 executives, in the top executives in the US, were sent to prison. What's happened this time is hardly anybody's been sent to prison. In the 1930s, the Pecora Commission was set up by Roosevelt, sent lots of top financial people to prison. And in actual fact, we won't know that the crisis has been dealt with until we see a lot of these people in prison.
Now, a lot of people have been saying that actually it's the charging of interest in the first place. The idea that someone has to pay back more than they've borrowed, and that usury, as it was called, which is the problem. Now, that's not illegal anymore. For hundreds of years, it was illegal to charge interest, and that was called usury. But so you're saying actually that these people are not getting over these older laws, that actually what they've done is committed fraud, which is a crime now.
Yes, what they've been doing is fraudulent, even in terms of existing law. And Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, wanted to ban over-the-counter derivatives, and she had her legs broken a decade ago.
When you say had her legs broken, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean by that is she was forced out because she was trying to insist that over-the-counter derivatives were unsuitable financial products. In other words, if we look back down the road, we will see various turning points where we should have done things differently, like the removal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999, was it?
And this is the act which separated investment banks from our high street banks. Yeah. Polly, what's your thoughts about the potential criminality involved in some of this financial mayhem?
Well, in the latest financial crisis, I completely agree with Martin. Talking about fraud with the derivatives, and Goldman is actually specifically set up, it has two kind of arms, if you like, and they trade with each other, so it's just trading with itself that's creating all of its profits. And like you say, I totally agree that it's fraud.
So Goldman Sachs, you've been doing a little bit of research into them. They've got two arms, you say. Where are they actually based, Goldman Sachs?
So they're based in New York, and they've also got a really big presence in Canary Wharf in London.
Okay, so these are kind of international companies, aren't they, Martin? They don't really seem to have a specific base, and of course that makes it nice and easy to move their assets around wherever is the most convenient place to put them. And that's something I can actually remember from looking at the company Shell in the Second World War. They had, for example, as the war was going on, they had half their assets in Britain and half in Holland, in occupied Europe, so they could see whichever way the war was going to go, they were going to win.
Well, Fanta, for example, if you think of the Coca-Cola company, they couldn't sell Coca. There are pictures of Nazis holding Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, the Nazi drink, but they realised that would mess up their American market. So Fanta was created for the Nazi market. So Nazi stormtroopers drink Fanta, which of course was the Coca-Cola company, but GIs drink Coca-Cola. Big companies always hedge their bets.
Okay, so if you had a chance to have a chat, Polly, to the board of Goldman Sachs, what would you be telling them?
Well, I don't know what I'd be telling them, but I know what I'd be asking them. I'd be asking how weird is that they have such a huge amount of power. And, it wouldn't just be Goldman Sachs I'd need to ask that to. It would need to be you know, governments and international institutions. It's like a kind of revolving door between politics and Goldman Sachs and, well, other large companies as well, but particularly so for Goldman Sachs.
But isn't the way they've acquired power simply by lending money at interest, and then as people can't necessarily pay, they put the screws on? In a way, they're kind of like loan sharks.
No, I mean, with Goldman Sachs, I don't think that's how they've acquired power at all. They don't lend money. How they've acquired power is by having this sort of revolving door that I've mentioned. So you've got like two former secretaries of the Department of Treasury in the United States, Paulson and Rubin. They, you know, were employees of Goldman Sachs. You've now got Mario Monti, who's basically the Italian Prime Minister in waiting, but also an international advisor of Goldman Sachs. I mean, the you could kind of list a whole list of names, but really, I mean, the power they've got, I think, comes from lobbying and advising governments and then becoming part of the government.
Well, we've seen changes of government over the last week in Greece, and or changes of Prime Minister and government, of course, as well. And we're looking at it in Italy as well. One of the comments on Newsnight this week from a London economist, I think it was based at SOAS actually, was that the markets are now choosing our prime ministers. There was the opportunity the week before to actually have a referendum in Greece, but they decided against it. They decided actually they would appoint the prime minister who was a sort of sympathetic to the markets. How have we come to the state where the markets are actually choosing our prime ministers? Because that's not democracy.
Absolutely not. But I think the interesting thing about that, I mean, the market, what is the market? You know, we've got a situation now where it's 73% of all the shares traded on the New York Stock Exchange are done by high frequency trading, which is just between computers. So, I mean, we're not talking kind of as it was in the old days where there were real people there, you know, like London Stock Exchange is full of computers. So when we're talking about, you know, the market is choosing prime ministers and stuff, the market really is kind of almost like a phantom of the imagination, I think.
Martin, what is the market?
Well, the market has collapsed in 2008. In actual fact, the stock market and the financial system was bailed out by the taxpayer in 2008. And the Obama election victory was the one historic opportunity we had to put this financial shenanigans back in the box. But unfortunately, the biggest contributors to Obama's election campaign were Goldman Sachs. And more than 50% of his money came from Wall Street altogether. So, of course, he started off by taking $100 from thousands of people, and eventually he became bought out by the system. And I'm afraid that these were the locust years. From 2008 till now, what should have been happening is a Labour government in Britain and a Democrat administration in the US should have been kicking 10 tons of whatever out of the financial markets, making them behave themselves. When Roosevelt came to power in 1933, he said, "Wall Street will hate me and I welcome their hatred." Now, what we've seen from politicians of the left in the last 4 years has been pitifully weak, and we're now going to pay the price. And I'm afraid that very soon, I'm afraid, what will happen is not just the collapse of the euro, but the collapse of the banking system. That's what, as we speak, the British Treasury is burning the midnight oil with a financial Armageddon, as it says in one of the stories we're looking at here. The British Treasury is preparing for financial Armageddon. I think the British people need to prepare for it as well.
Now, Polly, Martin's comparing some of the things going on today to the 1930s. As someone that studied economic history, would you agree with him?
To a certain extent. I mean, Marx talked about, you know, share prices and how they basically fluctuated independently of what was occurring in reality. So, you know, you had the Great Depression, and that started with the stock market crash in October 1929. And, you know, I mean, thousands and thousands of people lost their savings, you know, so it did have a real effect. But in terms of, you know, the factories still existed that the share prices were for, the people still wanted to work. So, I mean, there's something very destructive about the market, and we can see that now. But I think what we really kind of need to think about, and you're talking about Armageddon, Martin, and what we kind of, you know, is how much credit are we going to give the market? And if the share prices fall, you know, hypothetically to zero, does that mean that, you know, the ordinary shareholders have nothing? I mean, I think we need to kind of really think about these issues.
Can I just answer that? I think you're absolutely right. As Keynes pointed out, any country can produce anything that its people can invent and its resources can be applied to. And of course, what happens once the market crashes is that people realise, in actual fact, you don't necessarily need the market to do things. And of course, in the Second World War, the market very much took a back seat as people realised this is national survival. I'm afraid the market is just going to have to go hang. And of course, the follow on from the Second World War was very high rates, marginal rates of tax on wealthy people, up to 19 and 6 in the pound. And that, of course, gave the state the resources to provide first class education, railways, and so on and so forth. Now, ultimately, the only way to get out of a depression. Recession, what we're going into, is massive government expenditure on a new generation of infrastructure and skills for the people. And we say we can't afford that. I say, well, we can. We just got to make sure we do afford it. And that means that there's going to be a class struggle, basically, over the money, which we need to get back. I mean, what's happened with the printing of quantitative easing in Britain, I think that's the end of the condemned government's policy. They're cutting public expenditure, which has led to the economy dead in the water. And then they print funny money and give it to the banks to make up for the fact that the economy's dead in the water. Now, this is silliness. What you need to do is actually spend money to put people to work. And you've got to find the resources to do that, and don't let the markets tell you you can't do it. You've got to do it, and that's just all there is to it.
So what you're saying is they're trying to resurrect a dead patient, really.
Yeah.
Now, Polly, before we go on to have a listen to the banker's point of view, because we're going to hear from Bob Diamond in a minute, what more do you think we need to know about Goldman Sachs? Because we did hear a few weeks ago from this independent trader speaking on BBC World that Goldman Sachs rule the world, and now we've seen a couple of appointees to European governments who are certainly very friendly with Goldman Sachs. So who are these people, Goldman Sachs, who they sound like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, that are ruling things behind the scenes?
Well, I wonder if, you know, they might be. And I mean, what you have to think, I suppose, is that it's a business and it has employees and they kind of come and go, and it's where they're coming from and where they're going to, I suppose. So in the UK, for example, we've got Lord Brown, who conducted the Brown Review, which was the, for funding for higher education, and recommended that they remove the caps on tuition fees.
He was removed from BP, wasn't he, after some sort of corruption scandal?
Yeah,
and then he went on to decide what's going to happen with higher education. That's a bit of a funny one.
Yeah, and he was a former director of Goldman Sachs as well. I mean, you know, also you've got Lord Griffiths, who is vice chairman of Goldman Sachs International, director of Goldman Sachs Asset Management International, and is on the advisory board for the Centre for Social Justice. I mean, it's kind of quite glaring, the contradiction there.
I think that's right. And it's not just, I mean, Goldman Sachs would not exist without the TARP bailout in 2008. All of these hedge funds were going to go down. And at the time, I agreed with the Brown position, as it was, that we should nationalise the banks as an emergency measure. But then I expected governments in the US or in Britain to start asserting some authority over the financial sector. That has not happened. I don't think there's any case whatsoever for the European Central Bank, for example, to buy up bonds to keep these banks in
business. Look, if you or I had a majority shareholding in Lloyds Bank, for example, we would use it, wouldn't we?
Well, yes, but the philosophy was, Tony, that private banking is the norm and the nationalisation of the banking system is an aberration, and we will get back to the norm as soon as possible. So even Ed Balls, who's the shadow chancellor, was saying at the Labour Party conference, he said, what we're going to do with the money we get from selling our shares in the banking industry is pay down the debt with it. And I feel like saying, well, Lloyds and RBS just lost $1 billion. You know, Lloyds lost $1 billion last year, and they paid out $1 billion in bonuses. I mean, this is just ridiculous. There is no way, Jose, that these banks are solvent, any of them. And that includes Barclays, Bob Diamond's Barclays. Because if you actually mark to market the rubbish they've got on their books, they're all insolvent. And we've been running around for the last 4 years pretending that they are not. But they are. And the markets do actually work in the end. A market solution for our problems is a crash, so that all of these debts are wiped off. But it's a catastrophic solution.
Well, the chief executive of Barclays Bank, Bob Diamond, who Martin mentioned Barclays just there, is not to be confused with the JP Morgan boss, Jamie Diamond, gave a speech 2 weeks ago in the City of London explaining how banks can be cuddly. It was pretty tortuous and could have been written by a robot, but he did make three important points to stress how he thought the banking sector could and should rehabilitate itself with the press and the public.
To rebuild trust, in my view, three things must happen. First, we have to build a better understanding of how businesses and banks work together to generate economic growth. Second, we have to accept responsibility for what has gone wrong. Finally, and most importantly, we have to use the lessons learned to become better and more effective citizens.
Well, banks as better citizens, Polly. What about that? Do you think that maybe that they're actually doing a little bit of self-reflection and thinking that maybe the banking sector really does need to change?
Well, I think there's two things to say about that. First, I have an issue, and this spreads out to all corporations, of any kind of business entity being considered a citizen or a person. And obviously that's enshrined in law now. So I think that's the first thing to say. And secondly, you know, banks do lend money to businesses, and that's what they do. They lend money to people, and that's their function in society. So, I mean, you know, calling them better citizens, no. But I do think that they play a role.
He's calling, Martin, for a better understanding of the situation, isn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, this is just happy talk. You know, it's PR, it's spin, it's flim-flam. The fact is that all the banking system is completely interconnected through the derivatives market, far more so than it was in the 1920s and 1930s, for example. So you could have a banking crash in the Kreditanstalt collapse in Austria, and it took maybe 2 years for that to work its way through to the system to cause problems elsewhere. Nowadays, what will happen if the euro disintegrates over the next 48 hours, say, is that all of these credit default contracts will kick in, and there will be a nuclear style meltdown of the financial markets. Now, I'm saying this not because I want it to happen, but because I can't see any other option
but
that
Martin,
it will happen.
Martin, nobody wants that to happen.
No, but at the same time, whether we want it or not, that's what will happen, because that's what does happen. And von Hayek, for example, one of the founders of the Austrian School of Economics, and he was very much a free marketeer, he thought booms and busts were good. And I think he was actually logical in what he was saying. He's the best of the free market economists, in my view, because he was actually saying that, look, you've got to have a bust. I mean, the capitalist solution for our problem is for the banks to go bust, just like a steel industry. Yeah?
Yeah, I wanted to come back to you on that, Martin, because you were talking before about, you know, maybe kind of a solution would be to nationalise the banks. But what's happened so far is we kind of, you know, we perceive it as nationalisation, but actually as part of the, you know, EU state aid rules, say RBS and Lloyds, for example, they have to divest of their supposedly most riskiest assets. Mm-hmm. But those happen to be, you know, the assets that are backed by tangible property, such as mortgages or, you know, car loans. And what we're left with is, you know, 83% ownership in the case of RBS, but 83% ownership of a shell bank that's full of derivatives, you know, loads.
Yeah, I mean, we get all the rubbish.
Well, yeah, and it's not even, you know, really real, I don't think.
No,
I mean, it's
not.
Just numbers
on
a balance sheet.
These derivatives aren't really real, and you know, market capitalism is a rather ruthless system, and ultimately these derivatives are worth nothing, and they will go to market and they will earn nothing, and that's how it will go down.
But that's why I think, you know, it doesn't, if all the derivatives, you're talking about the interconnectedness, but if, you know, kind of the derivatives do implode, I think we need to kind of think for a minute and say, well, does that really actually make a difference to anything that's existing in reality
no,
right
it,
now?
No, in the long run, it doesn't. You're quite right. I mean, as we both said earlier, we've you know, a country has got its the skills of its people, it's got the resources. We're, you know, Britain is an island surrounded, you know, built on coal, etc., as we used to say during the miners' strike. But the fact is that the disruption caused by the crash, it is going to be dramatic in all sorts of places in the world, and therefore you then get political and social effects which you can't factor into any kind of economic equation. And then I saw the collapse, for example, in Yugoslavia in the 1990s with an aid worker there. The economy imploded, and then people turned on each other like rats in a trap, and then the problem wasn't the economy, the problem was the war. And of course, in lots of parts of the world, when the banks collapse, there will be civil war. Maybe not in Britain, we might be lucky, but in other parts of the world there definitely will be. And of course, once that starts, you really are in a mess.
But then perhaps there is a preventative solution. So, you know, you're right. You know, if we kind of don't start to think now about these derivatives and how much of them are on banks' balance sheets, and we continue to treat them like they are real assets and like, you know, they have some kind of worth and some kind of effect in reality, then if they all implode, it will, you know, lead to the things that you're talking about. But I suppose we could kind of prevent that perhaps by looking at them and examining what they are and thinking, actually, no, like, and just having a steady write-off for all the banks.
I totally agree with that, but that's what should have been happening over the last 4 years, is a steady write-off of the derivatives. Basically winding the banks up in an orderly fashion, possibly involving sending some people to prison, sacking other people, reconstructing them so that they do carry out the function you mentioned earlier, the retail banking function of lending to businesses and people to do things. It's the investment bankers who've invented this whole new way of doing stuff, and it's very new. It's only in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. And they've invented newer and more crazy things every year. And at the same time as they were doing this, Polly, It's all based on differential equations, and more complex differential equations, like the Black-Scholes theorem, which was the basis for long-term capital management. But at the same time all of this was happening in the 1990s, the mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot was finding out that in actual fact, he discovered fractal mathematics, which means that in actual fact, things aren't predictable in this way. So all of the complicated maths these people have been using to underpin the derivatives, complicated, fearsomely complicated, but one small flaw, just wrong. And well, this is the problem. This is the fundamental intellectual failure.
From chaos theory, then, to anthropology. And Chris Knight is a professor of anthropology. He was sacked from his job at a London university when he refused to cancel a big left-wing conference, although he was ordered to cancel it by his bosses. Let's hear what he has to say about what we just heard from Bob Diamond and Bob Diamond's idea of fluffy bankers trying to rehabilitate the banks.
I don't believe a word. Obviously, this man's got to give us some fancy words about we won't do it again. But we heard it all before, didn't we? During the banking crisis of 2008, we were told it wouldn't happen again. And here we are. I mean, the sovereign
what do you mean
debt
here,
crisis...
What do you mean here we are? I mean, the banks...
Well, I'm just saying here we are right as we speak with this, with a crisis which couldn't get any bigger than it is. And the crisis is owing to the fact that, for example, the Greeks are being told that they owe 100 billion euros to the bankers. And I'm just saying we don't owe the bankers anything. None of us across Europe owe them anything. They owe us. We bailed them out. Okay? Give us our money back. And to say there's going to be civil unrest is an understatement. I mean, when it turns out that people's savings, that you go to the hole in the wall and you can't get the money out, the machine isn't working, we're going to get riots in the streets. I know it's difficult. Difficult for people to comprehend in England the possibility of rioting in the streets and revolution, but this is impending. This is going to happen. What we're seeing in Greece is just the beginning. As I'm saying, the middle classes, when they go to the banks and try to get the money out, the hole in the wall, their savings, their pensions, when we know that our pensions are being attacked and people like Sir Fred Goodwin gave himself 700 million a year pension, the rage, the anger, the fury right now with this current collapse, when people, middle class people and others, go to the bank and try to get the money out, like they did with Northern Rock, and they find that they can't get that money out, then you'll see the middle class, as well as the rest of us, the 99% rising up. I'm confident of that.
Well, that was Chris Knight. Polly, what do you think of that? I mean, he's talking about actually saying that there may be civil unrest. Well, we've already seen the riots earlier this year basically not on the same exact point, but certainly to do with people feeling that the government doesn't represent them. What are your thoughts about what he had to say there, and also about the idea of these hole in the walls sort of freezing up?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I take a bit more of a optimistic view of things.
Glad to hear it.
Banking runs on confidence and trust, and now money isn't tied to gold. You know, it's not actually a problem that the notes are going to run out, I don't think. There's no tangible backing to money, so that fear is kind of really in our minds only. And, you know, what happened with Northern Rock was, because it runs on confidence, any kind of warning or, you know, any kind of preemptive action, that's what kind of creates the problem itself. So, you know, you had Northern Rock, and then you had the Financial Services Authority declaring that, you know, Northern Rock was that it had to have a loan from the Bank of England. That was reported in the media as a bailout, and in fact, you know, it was, if that had happened in the 1990s, that would have been a routine operation that nobody would have been told about. It's called a covert operation because it's part of routine everyday banking. And instead of doing that, they decided, the FSA and the Treasury, that they wanted to inform people. And that's why you got the queues outside of Northern Rock. So I'm kind of, you know, I think we need to be careful about making these scary predictions, really.
Covert operation. Martin, we've heard about covert operations in other contexts, haven't we? With the military and all sorts of dirty tricks.
I mean, the plunge protection team in the US covertly intervenes in the US stock market, and lots of observers note that the stock market in the US seems to behave in a rather perverse way. When other stock markets are going down, it goes up, and that's because there's a shed load of money being chucked at the stock market behind the scenes. But that money is taxpayers' money, and it is a covert operation. A lot of the gold bugs are very aware about this. I'm afraid I do agree that the banking system is built on confidence. And when in 2008, when the government stepped in to bail the banks out, I supported that as a stopgap measure. But I presumed at that point we would then move into a situation where people would really start talking about the role of finance in the economy and would start to sort of exert some, you know, the government would start to exert some control. They didn't, and as a result of that, I think it's not alarmist to point out to people that there is a real danger of a banking collapse. And it just, it's happened in other parts of the world. In Argentina, the Corralito, people turned up to get their money out and it wasn't in there. And that can happen.
Well, sorry, just to come back to you on that. You say that you supported the bailouts, but I'm just wondering why, because I don't actually, haven't been like researched them. I don't think they were necessary. So RBS, when it received £25 billion, well, when we bought £25 billion of its B shares, it didn't actually need them. The reason that it gave and the reason that the government gave was to maintain financial stability, to safeguard depositors, etc., and to increase its Tier 1 capital, which is the amount of shares that the bank has issued. Now, I mean, it wasn't necessary from a regulatory point of view. It wasn't necessary for, well, I can't see that it was necessary at all.
Well, I mean, there is an argument about this, I agree, because when Paulson said, you know, the collapse of Lehman Brothers and AIG and so on, he would basically, they blackmail the politicians to say, you bail us out or there will be an Armageddon, yeah? So there's an element of the bankers talking Armageddon up because they want another bailout. And I'm loathe to actually, in a way, help them by saying the things I'm saying. But frankly, I mean, I'm a sort of left Keynesian Marxist, really, if you were to analyse my economic views. And I'm afraid booms and busts are intrinsic to the capitalist system. This is a huge bubble, and there's only one end for that kind of bubble. It bursts, and that's what will happen.
But the bailout of RBS and Lloyds, that wasn't anything to do with the bubble. That was the government and the head of RBS agreeing that, you know, they would issue these shares.
But the specifics of our situation in Britain with Northern Rock and so on, don't forget, the big issue was the collapse of Lehman and AIG in the US. Yeah. Now, the system as a whole is incredibly fragile and interrelated, as you know. And the decision to bail the banks out, in hindsight, I perhaps wouldn't have agreed with it, because I presume that they would bail them out and then do something about managing the fallout. But they haven't. Yeah.
But if you look at the amount of money that we gave RBS, obviously it's a huge amount from the public purse, but in terms of RBS's balance sheet, I mean, it's nominal, really.
Yeah, but I mean, they were trying to preserve the confidence that you were talking about earlier. This is why they prop up particular banks in the system, because if they don't, then the confidence will go in. And of course, the derivatives market means that it will be transmitted to other institutions very, very quickly.
Can I just intervene a minute? Because I think it's actually very difficult to say whether it was the right thing to do, because we've heard since that a lot of the balance sheets of these big banks have been messed about with and that haven't been properly audited and accounted. Ultimately, though, there is a sort of talk. I mean, I think it'd be quite nice to go back to Chris Knight again now, because when Chris Knight was speaking earlier, there was someone else entered the fray in the chat with him, and that was Richard Hunter from our local stockbrokers and financial institution, Hargreaves Lansdown. Do you know much about Hargreaves Lansdown, Polly? Martin?
Well, I know a little bit. They're big cheeses in Bristol, aren't they? They are the financial sector in Bristol in many ways. And I saw Mr. Lansdowne speak at a BBC debate at Filton, where he made the priceless comment to all of the audience that the only way to solve the crisis was to get rid of public sector pensions entirely, which didn't go down too well with the audience.
I understand you know a bit about Chris Knight as well, Martin.
Chris Knight has written a very influential book called Blood Relations, Menstruation and the Origins of Culture, which has been very influential.
So he's basically an anthropologist, so he's coming at the whole financial situation from a completely different point of view to most of the economists like you.
Yeah, but I mean, all knowledge is a seamless web. Economics isn't a separate discipline. It's related to other disciplines.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Chris Knight having a chat with Hargreaves Lansdown's Richard Hunter.
They suddenly discovered the idea of Karl Marx, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. Suddenly the banks started asking for the community to bail them out. They had very big needs, all kinds of yachts to be repaired, all kinds of huge pensions and so on, and they asked us, the taxpayers, to bail them out. Suddenly they discovered communism. Communism for the rich, of course. That's what they suddenly discovered. I think it's laughable to somehow suggest that that crisis is the fault of government. I mean, it's like saying that it's single parent families, or it's nurses, or it's the
or
electricians,
banks, yeah,
or hospital
or
workers
banks,
responsible
yes,
for this crisis.
Blaming on one section of society.
I'm not. Listen, I'm quite prepared to admit that bankers could be nice people. Liberate them from their money. Liberate them from their institutionalized greed. I'm quite sure that bankers are very nice to their pet cats, maybe their kids, and so on. Let's liberate them, okay? From the mess they're in. I mean, they're in a mess where they have to be greedy. That's otherwise they're out, aren't they? They're bankrupt suddenly.
Yes, only a tiny contribution there from Richard Hunter from Hargreaves Lansdowne. Liberate the bankers, Polly, from their money.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure what that would entail, really.
Well, he's saying, basically, that they should be sacked, I suppose, from the boards of these banks and the people who are in charge of the money system replaced, simply.
Well, okay. I mean, I think, well, from my point of view, what needs to happen is a really kind of close and detailed sort of historical analysis of this financial crisis. And we need to go through the accounts. We need to look at the facts and the figures. And yes, it takes time. And yes, it's not, you know, the most interesting of tasks, but it needs to be done. And rather than kind of making sweeping statements such as liberate the bankers or just sack all of them, you know, specific crimes were committed by specific board of directors of specific banks. And yes, the financial system has problems, the derivatives that Martin and I were talking about earlier, but also we need to kind of take a level approach to this, I think.
Now, do you think that's a job for the police then?
Well, I think that what I think we need to have is a truly independent investigation. And yeah, I suppose, I mean, the police need to do that. They need to have advice, obviously, from people who understand finance and accountancy. But yeah.
But surely the fraud squad understand finance.
No, they don't. You see, the problem is partly the existing law hasn't been enforced. As I said, Brooksley Bourne was removed from the head of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, in the 90s. And basically, the problem is that, as with Enron, if one big institution like Enron or Goldman Sachs starts cooking the books and they don't get arrested and put on, you know, and charged, then everybody else has to cook the books to keep up with them. And so these kind of poor practices, these fraudulent practices, then filter through the system so that everybody is using them. Now, if we went through the books, we would find that most of these banks, in fact all of them, including Barclays, which claims to be making a profit, if you look at that, at the derivatives contracts they are holding, are worthless, basically. I mean, we should basically make the derivatives contracts worthless anyway. I mean, Myron Scholes, who invented the Black-Scholes theorem, which is the basis of derivatives trading, he has said, he's come out openly and said, we need to blow up or burn the derivatives market now. Before it implodes.
Because there is a danger, isn't there, Polly, that these financial instruments like derivatives are in danger of really tipping us into a situation where we could have a catastrophic crash?
Well, I mean, like I was saying before, I think if we had an orderly and all banks would have to do this, if we just started, you know, writing these derivatives off, then I don't see that it does need to be any kind of catastrophe, really. It just needs to be something, okay, you know, this was a mistake. These financial instruments don't reflect reality. They're just numbers on a page and we just need to erase the numbers.
So do you think that most of this talk of a crash is fear-mongering by people like Martin?
Well, I mean, kind of within political economy, we try to look at it as, I don't know, sort of crash... crises are social events, so they're sometimes things that are constructed by various groups for whatever reason. And the way I'm looking at this crisis is I think there's a lot of fear mongering going on, and you know, that could be a good excuse to implement austerity policies, fiscal union in the European Union, like they're discussing now.
Well, it's certainly worked, hasn't it, by the new prime ministers we've got in coming into Italy and in Greece. The Goldman Sachs have got their way.
Well, absolutely. So let's not, you know, let's not give it to them too easily, I don't think.
Okay, we're gonna have some music now, and then we're gonna come back to discuss some other stories, plus the William Hague's talk in the House of Commons on Wednesday about foreign affairs after this.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds. People gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run
Tracy Chapman there with her little revolutionary song. I haven't heard that one on BBC Radio Bristol recently for some reason. Anyway, the Tesco riots, brothers at the heart of the trouble, have just been jailed, we hear, in yesterday's Bristol Evening Post. The two brothers at the heart of April's Tesco riots have been jailed for more than 7 years between them. David Foster took a full role in violent clashes with police in Cheltenham Road and joined a crowd of looters in stealing cigarettes and other stock from the newly opened store, Bristol Crown Court heard. His younger brother Joseph, 21, was squatting at the building named Telepathic Heights opposite the controversial new store. It was his threats that he would, in inverted commas, petrol bomb the store, which sparked a major police operation to enter the squat on the evening of April the 21st this year. Now, Martin, what do you make of the final sort of results, really, of the police investigation into the alleged petrol bomb?
Well, as you know, Tony, we've discussed this since April. We've discussed this many times on this programme. What I find really strange is that on the night of the first incident, we had three out-of-town riot squads in Stokes Croft in Bristol, one from Wiltshire, one from Devon and Cornwall, and one from South Wales.
But why is that strange? The police have had intelligence that someone may have a petrol bomb. Isn't that kind of normal?
Well, it's not been proved that there was a petrol bomb. That's the first point. Don't forget that Joe Foster has been sent down here. He's 21, but he's got a mental age of 11. And as his lawyer said, he can't even spell the word capitalism. They are very much, you know, people who are not, you know, natural leaders in society, let's put it that way. What surprises me is why do you have three armed... there was 180 riot police, dogs, horses... the lot. Now, if I was a local copper and I found out and I got information that somebody was making petrol bombs in a squat, I wouldn't wait 24 hours and bring in three out-of-town riot squads.
But on the topic of the petrol bomb, allegedly, police decided to raid the squat and found what's now known to be a volatile organic compound. Now, quite what that is, in a bottle, although it was not flammable, so it certainly wasn't petrol, was it? A green container had traces of petrol and there were four disposable lighters. Now, it doesn't seem like there really was a petrol bomb.
Indeed. And what we suspect, Tony, is that Colin Port, who is a chief constable of Avon and Somerset, has been playing golf with Tesco's bosses, because we know that the local police in Stokes Croft came to the protesters outside Tesco's 2 days before the riot, or the incident, if we can call it that, and said, look, we're being leaned on to harass you. This is not going to happen, but heads up, something is. And then, sure enough, something did. And I suspect that Tesco's local bosses probably play golf with Colin Port from Avon and Somerset Police, who's got form. We know that his wife got the contract to put the IT in at Portishead.
Yeah, the privatisation.
Yeah. We also know he was involved in the Rosemary Nelson affair in Northern Ireland, where he spent 3 years in Lurgan Barracks.
He's now
investigating the RUC for the murder of Rosemary Nelson, and eventually he said there was nothing to see, but he was actually using Lurgan Barracks, where the people he was investigating were in Lurgan Barracks, and eventually the criminal justice system was so unhappy with his investigation of that somebody else then had to take it over. So I suspect that what we got there is a local power structure of Avon and Somerset Police working with Tesco's bosses to try and create an incident, which is why you end up with three riot squads who then ran riot. We know they did. The Welsh boys in particular broke lots of arms, legs, heads, and we've had a person in here, as you well know, who had their arm bitten off by a Rottweiler dog. And these are all just local people, not criminals, not ne'er-do-wells. Just local people.
Anyway, Polly, what's your reaction to this? I suppose ultimately over the whole business of whether a store like Tesco's should be allowed to open when there seems to be quite a lot of feeling against it and the rights and wrongs of that.
Well, I mean, I think that government and regulations need to make it easier for local independent businesses and harder for large corporations. And unfortunately, we have a situation where exactly the opposite is the case. So, you know, I don't want a Tesco's on every single road. I like independent local shops, and I just think that, you know, the right kind of regulations need to be put in to encourage that sort of investment, really.
The trouble is, of course, that the big companies like Tesco's are actually much more powerful, aren't they? So ultimately, are we going to end up probably with a situation with loads of these little Tesco Metro shops and no independent traders?
Well, I mean, and that's kind of where we have a responsibility, I suppose, as, you know, people of Bristol or people of cities or wherever. You know, we can kind of vote with our feet, I suppose, and, you know, maybe it's worth paying 20p more if you can afford it to go to the local independent store and support local businesses.
Well, just one recent story about Tesco's, their much publicised big price drop came under fire after it was revealed that dozens of everyday items increased in cost the weeks prior to the campaign. A 750 gram pack of supermarket's own brand fruit and nut, for example, cost, this is muesli, cost £1.28 on the 16th of August. It was repriced to £1.89 on the 23rd of August, and then apparently, in inverted commas, dropped to £1.75 in time for the September advertising initiative. That was reported in the Times, and the retail giant claimed to have cut prices by up to 35% on 3,000 items, but in an advert featuring 12 products, including bacon and orange juice, four were found to cost the same as they did, actually, 6 weeks previously. So this is the sort of tactics that big corporations can get away with, Martin.
Absolutely, and Tesco's, of course, were very instrumental in getting rid of resale price maintenance in the 1980s. Resale price resale price maintenance meant, for example, like basic things like bread and milk had to be sold at their cost of production or more. So in other words, what supermarkets would do is they basically have very cheap bread and milk to get people into the store, and then they take money off them for everything else. But of course, local retailers can't do that. They can't sell bread and milk at less than it costs them to buy it. And resale price maintenance meant a level playing field for big stores and small stores, and Tesco's lobbied to get rid of that, and they did get rid of it. So in actual fact, as you now know, Tesco's and other big superstores will have a lot of things which they sell at less than their cost of production just to get people in. Think of the I was talking to a chap who runs an independent cafe yesterday, Alex, who runs Monte Carlo in Stapleton Road, who's a very interesting chap. But he was just complaining to me that obviously Tesco's cafe, they run that at a loss because they're quite happy to run it at a loss to get people into the store, and that of course is really bad for his business.
I'm going to give the last word to you, Polly, on this, because I want to know, what can we do to actually encourage small retailers, where actually in the market system these big guys, they're just going to win, aren't they, and the small guys are going to go to the wall?
Well, I think Martin brought up an interesting point talking about the power of lobbying. And, you know, this goes right through. This is, doesn't just apply to sort of issues like Tesco's. I mean, it's just our government is pervaded with lobbyists and money. And I think, you know, as soon as you get one corporation with a large amount of money and then it suddenly becomes acceptable for politicians to accept money in order to create certain laws, then until we get rid of that, in my mind, you know, it's going to be very difficult to change.
OK, on to our next story. Bristol's councillors' cars were torched in a late night arson attack. This is Bristol's Lord Mayor and a fellow Tory councillor both had their cars burnt in separate arson attacks on their homes. Jeff Gollop and Kevin Quartley said they were both mystified why they should have been singled out for the attacks, which happened during the early hours, I think, of Monday morning. Lord Mayor Mr Gollop, who represents West Beyond Trim, was woken about 2 a.m. by the light from the flames through his bedroom window. His wife's Ford Fiesta was turned to a fireball. His Toyota Prius was also set alight but didn't quite suffer as much damage. Martin, do you want to go first on this one? I mean, this is a bit worrying, isn't it?
There's been another incident which perhaps the listeners need to be aware of, which is that in Bedminster some people broke into the police station there and burned a police car some weeks ago now, and they issued a statement on Bristol Indie Media saying that this was an act of solidarity with squatters in Amsterdam and it was just the beginning, etc., etc. Now, as somebody who's incredibly supportive of the mass movement, we need to change the situation that we're in. I see these kind of incidents as extremely, not only unhelpful, but positively damaging to our movement.
Why is that?
Because we are not in the business. Jeff Gollop, we've had in on this show, as you well know, and we do not fight our political opponents by burning their cars. And I speak as somebody who supported the Irish Republican movement for 30, 40 years. And of course, when you have to fight, you fight. But you don't play games with things like that.
Polly, what's your thoughts about this bit of news?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Martin. I think it's totally counterproductive, basically. And, you know, I think, like you were saying, you fight your political opponents by having this sort of intellectual and moral superiority. And obviously, you know, burning cars is not that.
But playing devil's advocate for a minute here, a lot of young people particularly feel completely disillusioned with the political process. They don't actually feel that the system represents them. I mean, if you go back to the 1950s, we had quite a lot of people actually members of political parties in this country. We had something like 80-90% of people voting in general elections and local elections too. So there's a complete disengagement from politics, and this may be one of the reasons why this has happened, because people feel that the politicians just simply don't represent them or are doing the opposite of what they want.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to the fact that there isn't really that big a choice, to be honest. You know, if you vote for one of the three main parties, you are voting for pretty much the same trajectory of policy. They're just arguing over kind of tiny little details, really. So until we get a much broader space for kind of open and honest political discussion and real alternatives, then, you know, perhaps unfortunately some young people are going to do things like this.
Well, is there any hope, Martin, do you think, of the current political system, the current political parties actually representing some of the views that these people, obviously very much anti-conservative views? I think it's a not really necessarily true of them to say they have no idea why this happened, because it's, you know, I would imagine anyway, you don't need to be a genius to work out that maybe this is an anti-conservative move.
Yes, and of course it may be that somebody is creating these incidents as well. That also happens. People from Ireland would know very well what happens in those kind of circumstances.
Well, how do you mean creating it?
Well, you know...
Deliberately?
For example, the Poppy Day bomb. It's 11th of November today. The Enniskillen bomb in whenever it was. I have been told by Irish Republican activists that it was their bomb and they did plant it, but that MI5 had broken into their structure and they set the bomb off early rather than later. They intended to let the bomb off later and kill a couple of policemen or a couple of soldiers, but the bomb went off while the ceremony was going on to create the maximum number of casualties. Now, that may or may not be the case, but that's the kind of thing that you will find in pubs in West Belfast. People will talk like that. They'll be wondering about who's infiltrating, what's going on, what's really happening, and they don't take face value what
they're
told.
So you think there's a question here as to whether this is...
There is a question
actually...
here. The anarchist movement in this country, and I've got great sympathy with anarchist views, could easily be manipulated by the intelligence services to do all sorts of things to discredit our movement, and I'm quite aware of that as a possibility, and we've talked about this many times on this show, Tony. The Western intelligence services are quite capable of carrying out acts of violence in order to try and discredit political movements. COINTELPRO in the United States, with counterintelligence propaganda by the FBI, it's all documented. We know that's how it works. In East Germany, the Stasi didn't work like that. They didn't need to. In the West, the intelligence services are there, but they are manipulating the social field in a different way.
Okay, and on to, as promised, the statement by William Hague in the Commons on Wednesday on foreign policy. Equally important for many, actually, is the attempt for recognition for the Palestinians. But let's listen, first of all, to William Hague delivering a Middle East roundup to the House of Commons, and top of his agenda was Iran.
Turning to Iran, today the International Atomic Energy Agency will deliver its report on military aspects of Iran's nuclear program. The report lays out clearly and objectively the evidence that the agency has uncovered of Iran's development of nuclear weapons technology. The Board of Governors of the IAEA will convene later this month to consider these grave findings. The assertions of recent years by Iran that their nuclear program is wholly for peaceful purposes are completely discredited by this report. Iran is ramping up its production of uranium enrichment to levels for which it has no plausible civilian use, but which could easily and quickly be converted into weapons-grade material. The uncovering of the recent plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in the United States also shows Iran's apparent willingness to sponsor terrorism outside its borders. Iran needs to change direction. We want a negotiated solution and have extended the hand of reconciliation to Iran time and time again. We are prepared to have further talks, but only if Iran is prepared to engage in serious negotiations about its nuclear program without preconditions. If not, we must continue to increase the pressure, and we are considering with our partners a range of additional measures to that effect. Iran's actions not only run counter to the positive change that we're seeing elsewhere in the region, they may threaten to undermine it, bringing about a nuclear arms race in the Middle East or the risk of conflict.
Well, Martin, another crisis, not just a financial crisis, but also a possible war with Iran. That's what they're talking about anyway.
Yes, well, and General Richards, who's the head of the British Armed Forces, is in Tel Aviv this week, meeting with his counterparts in Iran, in Israel, to talk about exactly that. Ehud Barak, the Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, was also here talking to the condemned government about exactly this.
But they need to be talking about it because apparently the Iranians, as we just heard, they're ramping up production.
No, what's in this IAEA report is exactly what's in the... there's nothing new in it. Nothing new in it at all. When Mohammed El-Baradei was running the IAEA, he said, look, there's nothing in this which leads to the conclusion that the Iranians are making
nuclear weapons. He's an Egyptian,
isn't
he? He's now standing for president in Egypt.
But what has happened now, they've now got a Japanese chap running it who's actually a Western stooge. The Russians and the Chinese have both come out and said, we're not taking any of this seriously, right? So the UN, if you're talking about the UN Security Council, Medvedev, who's the Prime Minister President of Russia, he's been saying this week any attempt at sanctions on Iran on the back of this report are not to be countenanced, and a war with Iran would be a disaster.
Okay, Polly, what's your view on the Iranian problem?
Well, I mean, I just can't believe that they seem to be saying this. We had, you know, Iraq, WMD, and then it's like maybe perhaps they think that, you know, it's been long enough that we've forgotten that they lied about that, so we're going to buy the story again. And, you know, they've been talking about Iran for ages. It's quite clear that, you know, both the United States, UK and Israel have a very aggressive stance towards Iran. And I just kind of can't believe that they haven't come up with a different lie, really. I think it's kind of insulting to our intelligence.
It is. I mean, the whole thing of the Saudi plot is an absolute nonsense. I mean, nobody in the rest of the world believes it. They've just written it off. And the other thing that's going on, the Iranians gave a press conference this week where they said MI5, CIA and Mossad are running terrorist operations inside Iran. So they're actually assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists. The Stuxnet worm is clearly come from the Israelis and the Americans, which crashed their nuclear reactors and may have played a role at Fukushima, by the way. And also bombs are going off. Jundullah is being supported in the east of Pakistan, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, a separatist movement, and they're bombing Shia mosques. They're carrying out all kinds of terrorist actions supported by our intelligence services.
Okay, on to our final story then, and just briefly, because it's been covered by almost all the press, blanket coverage yesterday, which is Tom Watson's confrontation with James Murdoch. As a recently started newspaper editor, Polly, what's your thoughts about the exchange where Tom Watson accused James Murdoch of working for the mafia, basically?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a very good soundbite, and it looks, doesn't it, like the MPs are giving, you know, James Murdoch a really hard time. But let's look at the facts. I mean, there were crimes committed, and instead of going to a court and giving proper evidence and being prosecuted, he's appearing in front of MPs. You know, Andy Coulson, former editor of News of the World, was David Cameron's, you know, personal communications advisor. And I mean, you know, I just don't... I was watching it yesterday on TV, and just thinking, wow, this is such a bizarre situation. You know, we've got MPs acting as if they were a jury and, you know, lawyers. And I just thought, like, what's happened?
So what should happen, in your view?
Well, I mean, it was a criminal case. So, you know, if Martin commits a crime, if I commit a crime, then we get arrested and we have to go before a court of law.
It's another case of impunity. We had a couple tonight, haven't we?
I think one of the weaknesses of the oligarchy is that many of them are criminals. And I don't mean that in a political rhetoric sense. I mean that they've got Interpol files.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, editor of Occupy Bristol's Daily News Digest, Polly Winch. And after the news, after a criminal hacking conspiracy is exposed at EDF, can we trust this firm who is still pushing forward controversial plans to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point? After the news.
Thank you. This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk.